Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, and welcome back, everybody. We've got a fun show for you today. And something that's really fun before we kick off another great letters episode. Have you ever wondered if there was a way to capitalize on all that online chatter, the millions of investors that use social media every day? Well, guess what? Your wait's over, because that same artificial intelligence technique that some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds use, that's now at your fingertips, and you can make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index, which is licensed to an exchange traded fund and trades under ticker symbol BUZ, provides investors with a portfolio of securities which show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. They don't use surveys. They don't guess. Here's how it works. First, they target the most mentioned large U.S. companies across the social media landscape. And the more active the conversations online, the greater the reliability of the buzz. So each of the most mentioned stocks is given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics. And the 75 stocks with the most bullish scores, those get included in the index. Each month, the buzz is tracked to capture the latest big data-driven insights. And then the 75 companies with the most bullish scores, those are selected, positioning Buzz to capture the highest return potential. Invest in the wisdom of the crowd. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. All right. Now, because we have our friends at Buzz Index taken care of, let's talk to two more of our friends. Let's start off with, I'm not sure where she is, but Lynna P. Jones from Be Wealthy and Smart joins us.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
I'm better now that you and I and the guy we're about to introduce just solved the microphone from hell problem.
I know. Well, I'm on the road traveling. I'm near the beach today and show off. Having a little technical glitch. Yes.
Yeah. I am not near the beach. I am near the heat, which is always fun. But yeah, good stuff. Glad we got your microphone working and glad you're here. And another guy who's here, I think, all the way, maybe halfway across the globe, Doug Goldstein from Goldstein on Gelt.
Well, Joe, if you go the other way, it's only a quarter way across the globe.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah.
I don't know how to measure.
No idea.
Well, if you go over to the top, you know?
Yeah,
you got that. Hey, how are you doing there, buddy?
I'm ready to answer some letters, aren't you?
I am. I actually like the ones we got going. Let's go.
Yeah, let's do it. So we're going to start off with this one from our new friend, Max. Max says, thank you for all the hard work you guys do. Love the podcast. My parents are retiring in the next couple of years, and I want to give them a retirement gift of $10,000 to $20,000. Whoa, how come he's not giving his favorite podcasters a gift of $10,000 to $20,000? What's up with that? How come parents get that love and we don't? But anyway, but I know they will refuse cold hard cash, so I wanted to know if there was a way to give them a gift in stocks, i.e. dividend aristocrats, small value ETF, large value ETF, fixed income assets, and if there's a tax-efficient way to handle this. My parents are my heroes. They helped me get through university without any student loans and are terrific role models. I want to show my gratitude, even though I will never be able to repay them, and I'd love to help them with their retirement plans. Just for background information, I'm sound financially at the moment. For the foreseeable future, I max out my company 401k, max out my Roth IRA, have 3 months safety account, no uncontrollable debts, and a fun pocket that makes up about 5 to 10% of my entire portfolio. Thanks again. Wow, Linda, let's start with you. Does this guy get son of the year or what?
He does. What a wonderful son. How sweet is he?
I know. It's amazing. So what does he do?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. He says that they won't accept the cash. I mean, gifting stock or something like that is a lot more complicated. So what makes him think that they're going to accept that?
Right, right.
I'm a little confused about that. But, you know, because he's from the UK, I don't know the gifting laws in the UK. I would suggest that he not just proceed on his own, but he gets some good counsel on this.
Well, his email, you're cheating a little bit though, Linda, because his email says UK, but he talks about a company 401k and maxing out his Roth IRA. So he might be an American living abroad.
True. That's possible. Yeah, it's hard to say. Hard to say. But yeah, I mean, of course he can gift stock. He can gift some stock in kind of a transaction, but I would still get good counsel on that and be aware of limitations on gifting laws. I believe we're still at 13,000. So he's got to be aware of that as a max. And, you know, I just don't know how they're going to accept that. I just think it's a lot more complicated to do this than it would be to give them the cash.
Well, let's see if Doug agrees. Doug, hopefully you disagree. We could have a big fat fight to start off the show.
I always agree with Linda, except the 13 number, which I think is now $14,000, is the amount you can give to any number of individuals. But he could actually, if he wanted to do this, which I'm about to come out strongly against, he could give up to 14 to each of them. So he's got plenty of space to give in terms of gift tax issues. And it's not even that he'd have to pay tax. He would just have to file a gift tax return. Anyway, Max, I want to share with you something that my father always said to me, because I remember once I tried to give, I think I was just giving money back, because I'm nowhere as good a son as you obviously are. And he said, Doug, money is like water. It flows downhill. And it goes from the older generations to the younger generations. And it appears from the tone of your letter, it's not that your parents need the money. It's not that they need the food, but you just are such a great guy that you want to help them out. I think the way to really thank your parents is, and I'm saying this from the standpoint of a parent, is to show them that you are self-sufficient and that you are managing money well and that you have money to give to your next generation. That's to their grandchildren. And heck, as a parent with a daughter about to get married, I am very excited about the prospect. I would never want my kids to be giving me money or stock. I prefer things like greeting cards and appreciation and, hey, maybe one day grandchildren. And if you want to do something with them and for them, which I think is what parents really want, you know, take them on vacation with you. That's a nice treat. But the thing about giving cash, I'm not really for it. And sorry, Joe, but I totally agree with Linda. Absolutely, I wouldn't try to give them stocks or ETFs or funds or anything.
That's so annoying that you two agree. but I think I agree also, but I'm going to give him a way to do it. You know, I think the cleanest way, to Linda's point, it's pretty complicated to transfer stock over to their name. If he has cash and he's insistent of going against Mr. Goldstein's advice here, there's a website called Stockpile. And Stockpile is a way to give gifts of stock, and you can even give fractional shares. And I've used Stockpile in the past. I have no relationship with Stockpile. I've used them in the past to gift stocks to my nephews and my nieces.
You're like kids. The most annoying uncle. Okay, Joe, I want to tell you another story now that we're talking about people gifting and people like you who go ahead and do this. One of the common things that people like to gift, at least in the Jewish world, are Israel bonds. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but it's like a common thing. You go, you give a bar mitzvah present of an Israel bond. And so someone did that to my kids recently, and they gave them like, I don't even know what it was. It was like $100 each or something. And we're American citizens, but we also live in Israel. And they didn't realize that when you gift these things, they're so complicated. Now we have to file tax returns based on this small gift. And so we called the Israel bond company and asked them, you know, for certain details that we would need in order to simplify this. And they said, they're in New York, and they said, oh, well, your bonds are actually held in Canada. Now, you might not think this is a big deal, but if an American citizen owns assets worth more than $10,000 outside the United States, like in Canada or in Israel or Europe or wherever, you've got to file a form called an FBAR, it's a report of foreign bank accounts. This is just a hassle. And by the way, if you don't do it, and a lot of people don't even know about this, if you don't do it, the tax can be up to 50% of the value of the account. So if you didn't do it for 2 years, you're going to owe 100%, the whole thing. You're going to lose all your money. It's a crazy thing. When you give people complex investments that they don't understand, like Israel bonds or stocks through some system, it is really possible you're kind of setting them up for all sorts of bureaucratic hassles, which I think you got to be sympathetic to your nephews and nieces.
Stockpile.com, Max.
we'll agree to disagree.
I'm not agreeing or disagreeing. I'm just telling him how to do it. He could figure out whether there's a hassle or not there. And there might be, but Stockpile made it really easy to actually get the transaction done. How it goes beyond then is fantastic. I love it, though, when my nephews tell me about how the stock's performing that I gave them. But they're in the United States, Doug, so they don't have any of that, you know, they have any of that issue. Our next letter comes to us from Georgie. Georgie says, been a listener for about 3 years. I've heard every episode. Oh, boy, Georgie. Born in 1993, I went into the market November 5th, 2015, after working with a stock simulator app for 3 months. I even managed some of my mom's money. Good for you. Georgie has a lot to say, and we loved his letter, but I want to skip to Georgie says he has a metaphor about the market, and I thought we'd get our panel's feelings about this metaphor. He says this is a metaphor for converting his peers into going into the market. I always love a good metaphor. I grab a cup of water and I pour water into it. I tell them money's currency. It flows like a river. What happens when the water in a river stops? Everything that stays still is dead. The cup is the bank. The water is your money. Now, you can watch it for days and you won't notice much of a difference, but really it's evaporating. Just how cash loses its value as time proceeds. The market, on the other hand, it's a never-ending flow. Yes, sometimes boulders and whatnot come in the way, but in the end, the flow of the market is that of a river. Given enough time, it'll cut through mountains and shape the land. He said this metaphor usually gets people excited. And he works in behavioral therapy, by the way. So it's really interesting. Georgie's, I'm sure, in his daily life, uses metaphors to help people. But Doug, let's start with you. Like that metaphor? Water evaporating is cash sitting still, and the flowing river is the stock market?
Yeah, I do like, first of all, I do like teaching with metaphors. So Georgie, I'm going to try this when I speak to some clients and try to talk to them about investing. I will definitely run this story by them. The one thing I'm not going to mention to them, though, is one of the things that you said, which I think is really nice that you manage some of your mom's money. And honestly, I also help my mom with her money, although she was a licensed investment advisor. You've got to be really careful, because when you manage money for people in your family, when you sit down at Thanksgiving dinner, you got to face them. As a professional, if there's some problem, you know, I don't have to see these people every day or every weekend. So just be real careful about actually managing money for someone else. It's great, however, if your mother has someone that she works with, that you participate in the meetings that she has and support her and be involved if managing money isn't her thing. But I would just be wary about, you know, specifically managing it yourself.
Yeah, good point there. Linda, how about you?
I like the whole metaphor of the flow. I think that's really cool. And the part about the cup being the bank, not so exciting about working with banks all the time, but I like the flow and being in the market and that part. I like that.
You know, the part of the metaphor that I actually like the best is the one I think people don't think of enough about, which is when the water stands still, it's evaporating. And people think that, you know, when we hear people talk about risk, Linda, they always talk about stock market risk, yet letting the money just sit there, to me, for your long-term goals, is a far bigger risk.
Right. Well, also purchasing power risk, because, you know, we talk about, oh, you need a million plus for retirement, right. But we're not talking about, well, how much is that $1 million going to buy by the time you retire? Because if that's 30 years out, 40 years out for some of our younger listeners, you know, the purchasing power just isn't going to be there. So we have to take into account inflation and, you know, try to get some grasp on what the purchasing power is going to be in the future as well.
Yeah.
You know, the problem with that is people never really know how to react to it. Not that they know how to react to the stock market crashing, which is often they just sell. It hits the bottom. They go, oh, my God, this was awful. I better sell, which really damages them. But with the problem with inflation is you just don't really see it happening until decades later, when all of a sudden your $1 million doesn't buy so much. So it's kind of hidden.
It is. And also, even a 2% rate of inflation over time really adds up. So it could be very low and very subtle now and for the last several years, but it can also heat up, but it can also just over time, even low inflation makes a huge difference to purchasing power and reduces it quite a bit.
Well,
using
your number, Linda, of 2% as an example, which I think is low, right? But using that number, it changes the game when you think that way, because if you think the goal is to not lose money, which a lot of people think that's the game, you think that getting a 0% rate of return is decent. But with inflation, really, you have to beat plus 2 to use your number. And once you start thinking about, I got to beat 2%, all of a sudden, the investments that you're thinking about and the way that you're managing your money changes significantly.
That's right. And it's what we call the real rate of return. So your return minus the inflation rate is your real rate of return. So you want that to be above 0. And you're right. If it's 2% inflation, you've got to make 2% just to break even and keep up with inflation.
Yeah, just to swim with the tide. Doug, you were going to say something. I cut you off.
You guys are totally right about the inflation issue, except in places where you're going to need the money in the short term. A lot of times I've had people call me and they say, oh, you know, hey, Doug, I want to invest my money. And we talk about their goals and their needs, and want to cut a long story short. It's that they've got, you know, $500,000 in the bank, and I'm thinking this is retirement money, and they're thinking they're going to buy a house in 90 days. And it turns out that the only thing they should be doing with that money is keeping it in the bank. And even though it makes 0% and they say, oh, it's burning a hole in my pocket, that's the time you have to be super safe and just suffer the effects of inflation.
Yeah. Our next note comes to us from Jeremy. Jeremy says, hello, everyone. Hello, Jeremy. I will start by saying I love the show and I'm thankful for it. It has helped me tackle my debt. I'm 26 and recently moved back home after a bad breakup. After that breakup, I made the decision to tackle my $68,000 in student loans and $12,000 in credit cards racked up partly because of my ex. I managed to pay off my credit cards and pay down my student loans to $37,000 in about 2 years. Wow. I have a great job with amazing benefits and a part-time job that's helped me do this. My only issue now is I don't know whether to continue paying off my debt or if I've made enough progress where I could try to save to buy a house. I don't have a big emergency fund, mostly because I know any true emergency, my parents would be able to help me. Most of my student loans are less than 4% interest, and now that my income exceeds my student loan balance, I feel much more secure overall. I'm just torn between my different options. Listening to podcasts like these have helped me, and now I'm taking my knowledge and helping my parents as they come close to retirement. Thank you so much. Thank you, Jeremy, for the kind words. And Linda, let's kick this one off. What's Jeremy do? Keep paying down debt or start investing?
Well, I just have to say first, we have the best listeners. Here is another son wanting to help his parents with retirement. Is that cool or what?
Wow. Well, I think they're okay, but they never mention helping their favorite podcasters. That's the part that still eludes them.
Maybe we should give our banking details here and they could actually send right. money directly to each of us individually.
Yeah, what could go wrong with that, giving our banking information on the...
Oh, we'll just put it online. I don't want to say it on the air.
Right.
I just think they're good sons. Safety and first. That's enough for me. But I think that tackling his debt is going to be much more important than trying to get a house now, because any loan that he tries to apply for, they're going to take that debt and apply it against whatever he can qualify for. So he's got to really tackle the debt. It's, you know, going to make it harder for him to qualify for a house with that debt. So he needs to get rid of the credit card debt. Good job getting rid of the girlfriend that helped you rack that up. That doesn't sound like that was a healthy relationship. So good for you, and good for you for having the extra job and moving home and reducing your expenses. You're doing all the right things. And I think just go ahead and finish paying off all those student loans and then start saving for a property, and you'll have that in no time.
Doug?
I love your model, Jeremy, about your emergency fund. My parents. So I just have to make sure my kids don't listen to this episode, because I don't want them to say the same thing. I note, if you're helping your parents plan for their retirement, are you sure that they are really a safe bet to be a retirement fund? But hey, that's between the two of you. Good for you for relying on them. I think I'm a big fan of getting out of debt. The only place that I would say to invest before getting out of debt is in the work-sponsored 401k or an IRA, because if you don't put money in every year, you lose the opportunity for that year. So I would definitely do that first, and then and at the same time pay off the debt. Once the debt's paid off, then you can go ahead and look for other investing. And my last comment, I really did like your letter, but you said you listen to podcasts like this one. I think you should basically only be listening to this one or the ones with the other panelists, because other people on other podcasts who I love and I'm friends with many of them, man, that's got crazy advice that I would never suggest to anyone. So really, at the end of the day, all these podcasts, including ours, it's just educational. It's just meant to talk about stuff and to give you some ideas. Make sure you're not actually doing specific investments based on, you know, what you hear from anyone who doesn't know you particularly and who isn't giving you customized financial advice.
But I love the point that all other podcasts are bad except ours. I think that's the takeaway there.
You and I are agreeing all day today.
I'll tell you two things about Jeremy's letter. I totally agree, Doug, with saving long-term, but also not just because you lose the opportunity, but also because the effect of that compounding is so, so big, starting early and often, like it's a Chicago election when it comes to your long-term savings is hugely important. And I also think that when it comes to the house, the one thing I would do, Jeremy, is look at the size house that you think that you want to buy. Use one of the many, many mortgage calculators online and look at what that's going to cost. Add some money, because of course you're going to need homeowner's insurance, and you're going to have an escrow account that covers that, and maybe also covers your property taxes. So calculate some of that and put that in your budget and see how that works in your budget. But use that money, save that money separately, or put that money toward your debt separately, so it feels like you're affording this house. I really like the strategy of pretending you own the house well before you own it, so that you're not using a bank's number of what you can afford for a house, but you're using a number that you've already play tested ahead of time. You know, what's funny is we were going to take a break for the Buzz Index, but we have a great note from Zach about the Buzz Index. He says, excellent show that's both informative and entertaining. I particularly enjoy the discussions when there's disagreement among the panelists because it generally leads the discussion to very educational territory. Well, Zach, you're not getting much of that today, which is annoying for me too. We're all kind of agreeing today. But my questions regarding the Buzz Index, some common investing advice would be wary and critical of newfangled products that are promising returns above and beyond what's considered standard for the overall market. Your listeners have heard this advice countless times from both guests and panelists. I understand you have to keep the lights or microphones on at the podcast, but can you discuss why your listeners shouldn't apply the same scrutiny to your most prominent advertiser? Joe's advice to personally evaluate whether the Buzz Index is appropriate for you most likely encompasses the obligatory be critical dummy warning, but the continual advertisement of the Buzz Index seems to be somewhat contradictory to the underlying goal of your program to educate the lay investor and to differentiate between the signal and noise, i.e. the Warren Buffett's from the Jim Cramer's. Buzz Index sounds a lot like noise. It's interesting, Zach, that you say this. And actually, it was time for us to do a mid-roll piece for the Buzz Index, but I think instead, I think we're going to tackle this. I tackled it with Jamie on an episode recently of the Stacking Benjamin show because I love this note. You know, when we talk about active investing, the issue with active investing is that it's some man or woman betting that they can beat the stock market. When we look at the reason why active investors lose to indexes, it's because the way, partially because of the way the active investment managers are compensated. They're compensated for staying close to the S&P 500. So it's actually better for them to lose to the S&P 500 by a little bit than to take big bets. So instead, what you see is not the Buzz Index, but you're seeing a whole wave of AI driven methodologies to try to create alpha. And it's funny when Jamie was on the Stacking Benjamin show recently talking about this. He was talking about, I believe the number was 80% of the return that the Buzz Index creates for an investor doesn't correlate with what's going on in the stock market. In other words, it's adding alpha. Now, it also is adding standard deviation. But for people that are looking for in their investment approach a way to have something that's different than what the index alone model gives them, I've got two choices. I can trust a manager or I can trust a system. And so it's not for me. When I asked Buzz Index to sponsor the show, it wasn't because I thought that the Buzz Index alone had this super duper way of investing. I do find it interesting enough that I invest in it. I also have liked the returns that we've seen over the short time that the Buzz Index has been around. I think those are compelling so far. But I also think that active investing has a place. I think active investing has lost its way because of the compensation of active managers. And what if there are systems out there? As an example, we also had Phil back on the Stacking Benjamin show recently talking about companies with higher approval ratings. That's another index. So we're seeing these indexes, this infancy of these indexes, and I find that incredibly compelling, which is why we asked them to sponsor the show. So I don't think that this is something newfangled. I think this is just the next wave of active investing. And I don't know, Doug or Linda, if you guys want to go near this at all, but I do think there's a new wave coming to active investing.
I think you said that really well. There's this new technology is providing some interesting additional information, and it's been fun to watch the Buzz Index and see how well they are performing. So I think it's exciting. We'll just keep our finger on the pulse and hang with it.
Yeah. Great question, Zach. And I know I've had similar questions because people hear about active investing and I don't think it's dead. I think it's evolving. So good stuff. Next question comes to us. So we're going to call that our Buzz Index mid-roll since we talked about them a lot. I should finish that off with, if you want more information about the Buzz Index, moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ to get that. And they trade under ticker symbol BUZ. And of course, like Zach said, I do invest in the Buzz Index, but you need to do your own homework, like Zach mentioned. All right. Mike says, I'm a noob at investing. Apologies for naivety. That's all right. You're in the right place, Mike. So back in the day before computer algorithms and quantitative analysis, one could employ good old hard work Buffett-style value investing to make responsible investments, but that's obsolete now. Now with markets saturated with qualitative analysis, robo-advisors, and giant indexes, the market's more susceptible to bubblage than it has been ever before. Large swaths of trades when the passive investment mechanisms sync up create surges in the market that dominate the market. He goes into a little bit here, Linda, about the market being more volatile. Have you seen stats showing that the market's actually more valuable, or the number's just bigger, so we think that it's more volatile?
No, the market is definitely not more volatile. In fact, it has been the least volatile that it's been in many, many years. And we measure that by the VIX.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, we measure that through the VIX index, which measures volatility. And what we've found is that the level of volatility has declined so much that I think we've had one 10% correction in early 2016. And that was the last time we had a swing that big. But it's definitely less volatile, and it's almost hitting record territory of being so unvolatile. So I would have to disagree with that and say the volatility has been taken out of the market. Perhaps that's by the quants that are working on computerized programs. However, should we see some event create more volatility or cause someone to have some fear, those, you know, buttons could all go on sell at the same time, like we saw in 1987, and you know, it could create massive downside, perhaps, volatility that we haven't seen in many, many years. So that could change at any time, that volatility, but it's definitely not been higher over the last couple of years.
Yeah, Doug, Mike goes on here to say that not only is the market volatile, it's less correlated to the management of the actual businesses. And we have seen the market continue to go up as we've seen a smaller and smaller swath of businesses doing as well as they were, let's say, a couple of years ago. Does that bother you?
Well, don't forget what it means when we're talking about the market. In general, people are talking about the S&P 500, which is not really the whole market. There's a lot more that goes on. And in fact, the S&P 500 itself, something like the top 50 stocks in that list of 500 represent more than half the return of the whole index of the S&P 500. So it's really hard to get a good understanding of, A, what's going on in the market overall by just looking at that one index. You know, Joe, I want to go back to something that I think is a little bit of a mistake that Mike is mentioning, in that he's trying to say that good old hard work Buffett-style value investing is obsolete now. I don't see why that's true. I don't think that's ever going to be obsolete. It is possible that at times value stocks as opposed to growth stocks are going to do better or worse, but it certainly does not mean that the concept of finding something at a really good value, just figuring out the value based on your own hard work research, and then looking to see if the market has not yet recognized that, and buying the stock at a price that you consider much below the value and holding on, I don't think that's gone. I don't think that's ever going to go away. There's always going to be, or presumably, let's say, I believe there will always be opportunities in the market for people who do good research and who are patient.
Well put, very well put. I have
a little bit more to say about that after you, Joe.
No, go ahead. Jump back in.
Well, I was just going to say, he started out by saying, you know, something about, not exactly this, but it's kind of paraphrased to say that good research is sort of obsolete. It's not the way that Warren Buffett used to do it. Why is that? I don't agree with that. Of course, it's not obsolete. And certainly Warren Buffett is still using his style to make investment decisions. I think a lot of money managers are using research and solid fundamentals to make good investment decisions. So I'm not quite sure where that is coming from. But
do you think maybe he's saying it's not fair because there's all of these fast traders that have super fast computers that maybe are just going to be able to out trade the value investors? Maybe that's what his point is.
It's possible, but we don't actually know what percentage of the market that is. So, I mean, we know that there are large hedge funds that are doing that, but you also have large institutions that aren't doing that. So, you know, I would say that good research will never go out of style, and you always have to do your research. You always have to look at the metrics. We talked about that in the last podcast. What are the metrics we can look at, and some easy ones and some more in-depth ones and things like that. I also am a little concerned that he's saying passive versus active, that there's more risk with active management. And I don't agree with that either.
I think he's actually saying the opposite of that. He says active investing gets a lot of flack for being risky and irresponsible, presuming the investor is uneducated or morally compromised. And passive investing often gets highlighted as a safe, responsible choice. But in a pessimistic mind, the aggregate effect of individual active investors in the market is less dangerous for long-term growth than a market subject to extreme swings. So I think he's saying, Linda, that the active manager is going to win, which is funny because we just talked about the Buzz Index and the changing of the active investor, right, in the market. And it seems like he seems to be taking more of the Buzz Index approach.
Okay. Well, my point is that the risk in the market has nothing to do with being a passive or an active investor. The risk in the market is the risk in the market. You have beta that is how a company reacts to a market average, and you have companies that are above that and are more risky, or companies that are less risky than that. It's not about whether they're passively managed or actively managed, or passive or actively managed. It's there's risk in the market that doesn't have anything to do with that. So the problem is that active managers have not been outperforming the market. And that's why active management has fallen by the wayside for the time being. And these things come in and out of vogue. But for right now, active management seems to be less popular because people can just passively buy an index and it has, you know, hung with the index. And active managers have underperformed the index, and then they have their management fees on top of that. So their net bottom line has been less than many indexes. So that's where the performance may be differential right here, but I don't think the risk is differential.
I think that when it comes to risk in the market, I think what he might be saying is that as more people go passive, right? If we've got a ton of people going passive investing only in the S&P 500, it becomes a riskier marketplace because we've got these, let's say, 500 companies in the S&P 500 that's dominating the landscape. I mean, we've even had Vanguard founder John Bogle talk about, you know, what if everybody indexes? And he said that we're a long way away from that, Linda, but there is a risk there that if everybody indexes, it's going to create a more volatile marketplace.
Well, there's certainly been a lot of quote buzz about that. People are saying that. I'm reading a lot of articles about that. And, you know, I think certainly on the next downturn, we'll find out if that's true. If everybody, you know, has their finger on the sell button at the same time, and all those passive investors aren't really long-term investors and perhaps don't have a financial advisor to be there to hold their hand through some of that downturn, which historically has been very helpful to many individual investors, then we'll find out. And that could very well be the case.
Our next letter comes to us from Antonio. Antonio says, "Hi, I love your show. My family relocated from Brazil in late 2014. We have stable jobs with a household income of around $400,000, which allows us some savings to be invested. Given the low interest rates in the U.S., would it make sense to invest in Brazil, where funds can pay around 10 to 15% per year? Thank you, and keep up the good work, Antonio." Let's go to you, Doug. What do you think? Keep the money in Brazil where he can get 10 to 15% per year?
The first question you have to ask is, why are they paying so much? I am no expert on Brazil, but if I recall, I think the Brazilian real, their currency, is down something like 25% or so in the last year compared to the U.S. dollar. So there's a reason they're paying a high interest rate. It's because there's all sorts of economic issues there, and they're trying to keep money in the country, money that's desperately trying to escape. So you might be right, meaning if you time it and you guess everything right, great, good for you. But I think this is a high-risk investment to go into Brazilian currency just to put it in the bank deposits. And it's a currency that really could continue to devalue against the dollar. That being said, as part of a diversified portfolio, I think that there really might be some possibilities there.
You know, I like, Doug, what you're saying there, because whenever I see hey, if I can get 10 to 15% per year for free, why wouldn't I do that? Well, 10 to 15% is never free. There's always something there. Good stuff. All right, Justin, you're going to be our last letter today. Justin says, "New listener here, and I really enjoy the show, but please tell Miranda to stop suggesting people invest their emergency funds in the market. I nearly drove my car off the freeway when I first heard her suggest that. It's not just a terrible idea, it's negligent, especially given the investing experience the majority of your listeners." To Joe's awesome point from the last episode, see, Justin's my BFF here. "You knowingly take a lower return on your emergency fund dollars in exchange for liquidity. This is the safe, sound, and logical advice you should be suggesting on the show. Nothing worse than having to deal with an emergency and a haircut, even if you get that tax deduction, Miranda." Keep up the good work. Love the show, Justin. I wanted to end on that one, Doug, because
Miranda's not here.
Because A, Miranda's not here, and B, Justin agrees with me. So, which I totally love that. But Miranda's not the only one, Doug. Getting back to what I was going to ask you, Miranda's not the only one that says, go ahead and invest a portion of your emergency fund.
Well, I'm not. Maybe Linda does.
I don't know.
I don't even like the guy who's counting on his parents to pay his emergencies off. No, I'm a big believer in emergency funds. I think that the problem is people don't want to pay for anything these days. And liquidity costs money. If you want liquidity, which means access to your money, it's going to cost you. And that means it's going to cost you the potential of losing against inflation, which we spoke about before. It's going to cost you the opportunity cost of not investing in the next really great thing. That's the cost of having 3 to 6 months worth of money readily available, not in the stock market, not borrowable against your 401k, cash on hand in the bank that's available to you all the time. I'm a big emergency fund kind of guy. So Justin, I disagree with Miranda on lots of things, mostly political. And she told me we can't talk about that anymore on the air, but I disagree with her on this, but you and me, Justin, we can be on the same page as a real emergency fund.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to leave it, especially since Linda had a Me Too earlier. So, Linda, we'll start with...
Miranda's not here to hear us talking about
yes.
it.
Yeah, Miranda's not here this week, but she will be back next week. So.
Yeah, she will be. But you're right, Justin, she's a total loser on this thing. I can say that when she's not in the room. Oh, that's bad. Linda, what's happening over at Be Wealthy and Smart?
Well, at Be Wealthy and Smart this week, we have different ways. I have 17 ways to invest a small amount of money, like $300 to $500. I get that question all the time. Where should I invest? And I have some traditional investing ideas as well as some out-of-the-box investing ideas at lyndapjones.com/podcast or Be Wealthy and Smart podcast.
Awesome. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. And Doug, what's going on at, well, you tell me.
Well, at richasaking.com, which is the website based on the book about how the strategies of chess can be applied to making you a grandmaster of investing, my most recent show is a podcast is called What You Need to Be Aware of When Looking for Great Mutual Funds. So we spoke about mutual funds today, and I talk a lot about that at richasaking.com. You know, and one thing I've also been doing a lot recently, believe it or not, is I've started tuning into the Stacking Benjamins show, Joe.
Crazy.
Which I really enjoy. It is crazy. Tell me what you've got coming up so I can begin to lick my lips.
You are the master of segues, my friend. coming up.
Licking lips thing I'm a little bit wondering about.
You know, Diana Enriquez back in 2011 wrote this fantastic book called The Master of Lies about Bernie Madoff. And she was a reporter for the New York Times who actually before the scandal knew Bernie. And because of that, Bernie allowed her to interview him while from prison. And so she had some uncommon access. Well, just recently, HBO had their biggest film in the last 4 years with over 2.5 million people watching called, shocker, The Wizard of Lies. And it's based on Diane Enriquez's book. And stars Robert De Niro and Michelle Pfeiffer in that film. And guess what? Diane Enriquez is coming on the show to talk about it, to talk about Bernie Madoff and to talk about her interviews with him and to talk a little bit about her cameo appearance where she got to play herself. And it's kind of a funny story. So that's what we're doing on Stacking Benjamins. That's going to do it for today, everybody. Thanks for tuning into the show. If you'd like more about anything that we talked about today, head to our show notes at moneytreepodcast.com. That's where you'll find the show notes. Also, thank you to everybody who's left us a review of the show. And I say everybody, do you know that we haven't had a review in a while and it's making Doug Goldstein cry? And if you've ever been in the room and Doug Goldstein's crying, it's kind of awkward. So please leave a review of the show so that people know what they're getting into and they listen to the Money Tree Podcast. That helps people find the show. And we're very thankful of everyone who's done that so far. And remember, says Miranda Marquette, who's not here this week, no one cares as much about you.
About your money as much as you do.
So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.
No one cares as much about you.
About your money as much as you do.
So invest in your life. Oh, that was good.
We care about their money if they would just send it in to us.
We keep saying that. Nobody does.
Yeah. Someone's going to take us seriously someday, and then you're going to be regretting that. Right, right.